University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She is a postdoc over there. And she's going to talk about emergent space times.
So, before I start, I would like to say two things. The first one is I want to mention some of my collaborators I've worked over the last 4 years with. So, I would like to mention my sister, Stefano Liberati, Chris Chain, Angela Wright, and Christine Gardner, and also Phil Arnold, who I started working with in Vancouver. And I have to apologize when I prepared this talk, I got carried away. I got very I have too many pictures, too many movies, maybe. But it's a fun project, really, working on emergent spacetimes. And the message I want to bring across to you is that in nature, indeed, we have a lot of emergent spacetimes. So these are not just theoretical ideas. They are real objects. They're real, really there. So I wanted to say a few things about spacetime geometry and general relativity at the beginning. Then I want to convince you, I try to convince you that we have a world full of emergent spacetimes. I want to tell you then what is the concept of emergence. How can you basically, what does it mean that spacetime is emergent? And finally, I want to show you which basically, so here this is a fun part really. And this part here is these two things you see, there's a lot of work I've done together with my collaborators of the last 4 years. And the last thing is, where is this field going? Can we go from an emergent space-time to emergent gravity? So let's start. So the first thing is on space-time geometry and general relativity. So when Einstein came up with, so this is very, very introductory, but I need this because I want to convince you that space-time, the notion of space-time, can exist without the Einstein equations. So at first, if you look at this, you say, okay, when Einstein came up with Einstein gravity, there were two fundamental concepts. And one was the geometrical presentation, the geometrical picture of gravity. So gravity, if you have free falling particles, So in gravity, basically, it's a forceless theory. Objects are following geodesics rather than there is a force acting on them. So in this sense, this is actually the crucial point why you have this emergence baseline. It's not a force, like little sound waves in a fluid can follow, like, you know, propagate through this fluid as particles following geodesics in real spacetime. So, and the Einstein field equations, of course, is something that comes on top of it. So, but this actually requires, I mean, you all are familiar with these equations. I just want to say, so for this, you need much more. So you can have space-time really without the notion of this Einstein field equation. And the way it works is the following. So I want to explain this slide by giving you some answer first. So here we have space-time. Usually what we have, we look at the Einstein equations, and the spacetimes we're getting are a solution of the Einstein dynamics. Or if you have spacetime, you can calculate, for example, the stress energy tensor. So this is what we know from GR, this concept together. So but I want to show you why this red arrow here, why we have this one here, because there are a broad class of systems with completely different dynamics. There is an electromagnetic wave band, we'll talk about fluids, ultra-cold gas of bosons and fermions. And you see that in this condensate system, this completely different system, space-time can be emergent. So the question is, of course, so I have space-time, but this space-time, at least the general dynamics, maybe there's a subset of dynamics which actually, you know, maybe you find some condensate system, some fundamental system with microscopic degrees of freedom, so that then you can find actually a macroscopic description of this system where you can reduce the subsystem to Einstein dynamics. But the spacetimes I'm talking about in the following, they don't have this. So we have spacetime without Einstein dynamics.
Sorry, what do you mean by spacetime? Do you include a metric or just topology, differential metric?
So what I mean with this is that when, so we will derive this in the next few slides. So a spacetime is there basically if you have a kinematic equations for some field excitations. that those are governed, or those are dominated by some effective geometrical tensor. This is what I refer to as space. So we'll come back to this slide actually at the end, but so far I just wanted, in this talk I want to convince you really that space-time can stand on its own. It's not something owned to gravity. So this is what I'm going to talk about. These are some of the models I'm going to explain. So I took this back to Niagara Falls, the Horseshoe Falls on the Canadian side. And this is an example for an emerging spacetime. So every water, if you look at it, if you look at sound waves, it looks like an effective emerging spacetime. And the first paper, it was actually Delandro who came up with this. It's 20 years ago, 25. And what he did, he took, he took the hydrodynamic equations for fluid. So that is the continuity equation and the Euler equation. He looked at a specific setup for the fluid, so it was an irrotational, a barotropic inviscid irrotational fluid. And what he did, he looked at small excitations. He calculated the kinematics for sound waves in the fluid. And what he found is, with some manipulations, you could rewrite this equation here. This is basically, this phi is a background velocity potential, and this is a perturbation in this. So if you write down for a perturbation in the velocity potential, if you write the kinematic equation, it looks like this, where you've introduced this so-called effective space-time geometry. So let's discuss it for a few seconds. So what does this mean? So this, if you look at this object here, c is the speed of sound, and v is the background velocity. Now so basically these are all macroscopic variables showing up here. So obviously you don't need the water molecules to describe how sound waves, which are perturbation in the macroscopic variables, propagates through this water. So let's take again, let's say this is something around the Horseshoe Falls. So let's look at sound waves. Let's assume we're far away from the falls here, and these circles are, we throw a stone into the water. And then we watch the sound waves, how they propagate through it. And we imagine we are far away from the falls. We imagine always the velocity is almost zero. But how do sound waves propagate through it? Everybody knows that they spherically they propagate outward. So the different colors correspond to different times. If you then go closer to the falls, the fluid velocity is going this direction. So if you see, basically, sound waves are getting dragged along with the fluid flow. And then let's imagine this is very specific. Well, there's a point in this fluid where the velocity of sound equals the background velocity. So what happens is actually, so this is exactly the borderline before going supersonic. So what we see, first of all, we see, of course, sound waves here. If I initiate at exactly this point, I would throw a stone into our fluid, I would see that actually no information, no sound waves can escape. They would all get completely dragged onto the fluid. So if I would be here, someone waiting here for a signal would never, the signal would never reach. So if you look at our space-time geometry, our emergent, this is when chi node becomes zero. So we know this is actually a black hole. And at the point here, when these two things equal, the background velocity and the velocity of sound, we sit at the horizon. So it's affecting the horizon. We shouldn't call it like an event horizon, but it's a horizon. And of course, then this inside, let's say the river keeps on speeding up, and on this side, really everything is supersonic. So the sound waves completely have to. This is like the inside of our black hole. So it's a very simple analogy, but it's a mathematical exact equivalence because we have this space-time geometry. And Bill, when he did this, he did not only find this analogy; he also said, "But if there is a horizon, then there has to be Hawking radiation." So this is something actually very important. These analog models, since they don't have anything to do with real gravity, they make you think, what actually for Hawking radiation do I need? And for Hawking radiation, really, the only thing you need at first is the notion of space-time. You don't need Einstein for dynamics. For example, for entropy, so that's a different issue. But for the Hawking radiation, all you need is space-time. So having a class of models which can actually reproduce space-time which can have horizons. We can use them to set up little formulas to have formulation to mimic cosmological particle production. I will also show you how you can use this to learn something about quantum gravity phenomenology without even really having gravity. And so.
Yes. Sure. Go ahead. In analog model, do patients have aggression?
I come to this. So you're right. So when I say, so why does Hawking radiation not need necessarily, you know, aggression? Why can't I just look at the kinematics of the gravitational field? Well, the answer is, first of all the derivations we have are actually carried through in this, you know, under the in the spirit that the back reaction effect will be so small we can neglect it. Yes, that is true. So obviously I also show you a case where back reaction then becomes significant. So if you produce a lot of particles, if you do something really violent, if you really perturb your quantum your fields, then of course you need to include back reaction. And that is usually the limit where the knowledge breaks down. Unless you would have a better analog model. But also like say some subsystem of the dynamics will be some sort of Einstein dynamics. And I'll talk about this as well. Just mention it.
Okay, so question, if you go back to this one, this equation down the corner. So this is the equation satisfied by the perturbations in the fluid flow.
Yeah.
With this G. So this is diffeomorphism invariant because it's the divergence of the vector density. So do you know where in fluid mechanics the is the origin of the diffeomorphism invariant of the fluid equations?
Origin. So you say what makes basically Lorentz symmetry emergent in these models?
Not, not just Lorentz Lorentz symmetry is an issue, but also general covariance. So we wouldn't necessarily think the fluid. So if this comes from the equation for fluid dynamics, you put them in that form, and all of a sudden they have the gauge symmetry. I mean, you don't have the Einstein equation, but still you have the some gauge symmetry there.
Okay. What really, you know, what is the deeper mechanism behind it? I cannot answer that. I don't know.
That's true. That's important.
Yes, it is important. So I'll talk a little bit more about, well, I think also, why don't we talk about this later? But it's a good question. So, let's look at the following of this. So what this is basically, that's a fluid flowing down a drain. So this is in San Francisco. I don't think it was a very nice time to be there because it was in the middle of a square. But what it really is, what it is for little sound waves inside the fluid or sound waves on the surface. So on the surface, you also have little ripples. And this is basically the surface is a 2+1 dimensional space. And now here's a question. I mean, could this be a rotating black hole? So could it be, like, for example, that it's not really nice to So this was the idea. So I worked with Matt Visser and I for our first project. We looked at the possibility of actually, can we set up an analog rotating black hole? And there is this, so, and there is a problem here because this emergence space times, as you've seen in the previous slide, have all these points. So what this means, they're all diagonal on the spatial slides. There's a theorem stating that actually you cannot cast the rotating black hole into conformally flat spatial slides. So you cannot cast it in a form like that. Therefore, this means really you cannot mimic the whole acoustic. You cannot mimic the whole curved black hole. But we found out, so what is the interesting part here is that you get this ergo region. Because if you have an ergo region here, let's say this time when the sound waves enter here, it cannot stand still. It has to be following it has fine frame dragging. It has to follow the fluid flow inside. So it's so basically, we form this event horizon. So between this would be the air horizon, and this would be event horizon. So what you would see basically, you could use these things for super radiant sketching. So you could have super radiant sketching of sound waves. And there is another problem. You can basically something which is really remarkable that you know we have no description for fluids with a vortex. In the sense we can only approximate it for wavelengths much larger than the vorticity. So in some sense, there is no, obviously, if we come closer to a vortex, there still should be the notion of sound waves, but you cannot derive this. So an outstanding problem really in fluid dynamics. But within this approximation, you can calculate, and indeed, you can, in principle, it is possible to set up an ergo region. So the idea we had then, we didn't really look at it, but what about, could it be possible that in nature, you know, not just by setting it up, by using some external forces, for example, using magnetic hydrodynamics or whatsoever, could it be that in nature there is already a rotating black hole? And the idea was we look briefly into the situation, what about tornadoes? So we know for tornadoes actually, could we, for example, miss, could the howling of the tornado be a super radiant scattering effect? So why do we think this? Let's say this would be really the center of the tornado. It is that the wind velocities coming closer to the course, they're like one over r. So certainly, let's say the speed of sound is roughly constant. So you would, in some sense, what I need is, yeah, I should encounter a there should be like basically from a distance r, where basically the speed of sound equals then the velocity of the wind, because the wind velocity gets faster and faster and faster. So, however, there's a problem, because inside the core, the physics is different. So the wind velocity is like 1 over r. Sorry, scale like r. So one could now look at this in the following way. Because of this way, it seems we looked at what are the maximum wind velocities from tornado observed, and the maximums are 0.5 Mach. So 1 Mach would be basically equal, the speed of sound would be equal to the fluid flow velocity. So it seems that in nature, things like that everywhere. You cannot form, for example, a singularity. I was talking yesterday actually with Tom Goodsell about it, and he said he also looked at this problem and he said maybe the fact that you have, maybe you would have super radiant scattering, but if you have it, this would take energy away from the tornado, which could also prevail basically forming this, this ergo region. So I've never thought about it this way, but it's a very nice way to think. I mean, it doesn't have to be like this, because if you look at the core of the tornado, the physics really change. It's viscosity, it's not a fluid anymore. But it seems that at least, you know, basically, I also looked at the data, and it seems that on some Saturns and some tornadoes on Saturn, Saturn, there are, they claim there are patches where you really have supersonic airflow. So I need to speed up because I want to come to the core. So the other thing is, people always keep on asking me, has anybody ever said that would, like, you know, a black hole, for example? And the answer is yes, and it is pretty simple, and it's done by Bill Unruh and Ralph Schutzhold. What they've done, they looked at gravity waves, so they looked at surface waves on water. And what, because what is really, it's a really nice way that how the velocity of the gravity waves actually scales with the depth of the basin. So you have a basin, a water flow, and the surface wave, the velocity scales with the depth of the water. So if you make it smaller and smaller the depths, if you decrease the depths, basically you can encounter a point. So what this is what they've done. This is from the experiment that you will see. So you have a fluid flow flowing in this direction. And what you see here, you have basically a standing wave. Here's a white hole horizon. So every single wave coming from this side cannot enter. This is an example for a white hole horizon set up in the lab. But of course, again, you cannot measure any, you cannot detect any Hawking temperature or whatsoever, because the noise, you know, the temperature of the room effect is too small. But this is an example for a white hole. So the next thing is for more or less pedagogical stuff is electromagnetic waveguides. So It seems I make a lot of advertisement for Alf and Bill, but indeed they came up with really nice models. So they looked at electromagnetic waveguide, such as can basically manipulate electromagnetic waves. And wavelengths much longer than the letter, basically letter step is delta x, really experience an effective curved spacetime. So this is what they found out here. Now I need this for later when I do quantum gravity phenomenology, because there is some correction comes into it as well, and I want to read this for later. So the rest of the talk we will mainly talk about Los Angeles condensates, because this is an excellent example where we know, we very well understand the microscopic physics, and from the microscopic, from the fundamental bosons, which interact in ultra-cold atoms, we get the notion of a space-time emergence. So I want to...
Can I ask a question? Well, if you go back for example, you were talking, this was water waves? What were those waves?
Gravity waves, surface waves.
But,
yes.
But the fluid was water?
The fluid is water, yes.
Does one expect some sort of quantum explanation in the description to be valid for those waves, even in principle?
So, I'm not sure if I understand. What do you mean? So, you can, of course, you can quantize these little ripples as well. I mean,
that's what I meant. Wonder.
Yes, yes, you can.
Is that known? I mean, because the point is, it's more, you know, it's not a crystal or it's not a superfluid. So
yes.
It's something I've always been curious. Can you say that there are, for example, phonons?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, so basically, you don't really derive the quantum description from something fundamental. So basically, people just, you just have to have these classical excitations, and the philosophy is you just quantize it. So people do this, but you're right, there's nothing, you know, where you quantize a classical system, which
well,
is possible.
People do it outside this particular quantum.
I don't know. I don't know. So if it's only people working in this field that have ever done this, I don't know.
But it's generally assumed that you, they generally assume that you could quantize this water.
Yes. So we will, but for the next, for the BSD, it's different, because then we can really derive the quantum structure. So now, what is the concept of emergence? I have to say that there might be other ways. I don't say that this covers, you know, the whole concept of emergence in general. However, for the Bose-Einstein condensate, that's exactly what's happening. I think there's a broad class of system where this is describing how space-time is emerging. So first of all, we have a microscopic system of fundamental objects. Could be anything. Could be anything with the strings, atoms, molecules, whatever, bosons, fermions, whatever we have. So this I would call, if you like, the high temperature phase. And then there should be some phase transition. Basically, where we switch from the microscopic degrees to freedom to macroscopic variables. So in the Bose-Einstein condensate, what really happens, you cool down the bosons, and what's happening is that basically the momentum gets smaller and smaller, and they have to fill up the whole trap, so they grow. So everything is occupying the ground state, and they have this, all atoms are in the same macroscopic wave, they have the same macroscopic wave function. And this is the Bose-Einstein condensate. So then you have a geometrical object. So this basically is from high temperature phase to low temperature phase. So we change the degrees of freedom of the system. In the Bose-Einstein condensate, it's a first order phase transition. And if you look at small ripples in the condensate, I mean, the condensate is a superfluid. Again, what do you need? You need to have some sort of geometrical object that is dominates the propagation in this system. So in this geometrical object should better be some Lorentzian space-time, should be some symmetric tensor. And it is seen by inside observer. So it's not outside, it's not a black hole for us, it's just for the little ripples in the quantum state. So and last but not least, and this is very important, every analog model we're talking about today must exhibit a Lorentz symmetry, it's just an immersion symmetry. And for long wavelengths, everything looks like a nice mean field. Short scales seem so different. Short scales, you recover that the space-time is actually made out of something. So eventually, you discover the microscopic degrees of freedom. So here's what I said. So look at this. So here, let's go through step by step. So on the Bose-Einstein-Hollandseid, what we have atoms. They are intercooled with interacting, means we only allow them S wave scattering, only two particles at a time. They don't form molecules. So the interaction is repulsive. So you need actually, so Bose-Einstein-Hollandseid needs interactions, because you also see like this condensate is at the temperature. In order to be at equilibrium, the atoms have to speak to each other. So what you see, so here is your Hamiltonian, and what you see is just a kinetic term, it's a trap, and this is the interaction term. And it's important now to look at the symmetries. So one symmetry is, we know that it has an SO2 symmetry. So if it is, and there's a Nambu-Boltzmann theorem, if when you basically, when you form, when it condenses, it breaks the symmetry spontaneously and you get massless excitations. We come back to this because you can break the symmetry explicitly, and basically this will result in massless excitations. So you can also find, by knowing to play how to play with the initial symmetries, you can actually find analog models for massless gamma things as well. So then you have this dominant mean field regime. And what this means is that you have a non-zero expectation value. So you have this classical wave function and our macroscopic variables are here the density of the condensate, so the amplitude and the phase. So these are our two macroscopic variables. Then, yet again, I mean, it's a superfluid. Again, if you linearize, you get again the continuity in Euler equation. And what you see, you have this, this basically effective space-time coming up. So it's kept in the same way. And then, of course, here, if you look at the full dispersion relation in a Bose-Einstein-Hollandseid, it's called the Bogoliubov dispersion. And this has this form. So at low energies, at low wavelengths, you just have basically C0 is the speed of sound in this analog case, where at high energies, you get this case of force modification through the dispersion relation. So what it actually tells you here, these are the phononic modes, and these are the transphononic modes. And what it really interpolates for very high energies, this is just the free particle energy of the of an individual boson of the quantum. So this is kind of remarkable, because in some sense, you have your macroscopic variables, and the direction you get seem to be connected to the microscopic theory. And it really interpolates nicely between these two regimes. Of course, it's not that straightforward, but it is already. So this is a modification we get, and we know that this must come from the fundamental atoms because the mass m of the fundamental bosons comes into the game. So it really interferes between these two regimes. So what I'm saying here is now we have a preferred frame, we have an inner observer, and we have an outer observer. The inner observer, these are the little ripples in the condenser. They really experience an effective space-time. And what the variables for them is the field theta and the conjugate momentum on the emergent spacetime. And you can actually derive this starting from the fundamental second quantization. You write down the creation annihilation operators, and you do basically all, everything you do, you condense, so you say starting from this, and you say this goes to. This will be your perturbation, basically. Then you say, I go to non-Hermitian operators. I go from, it will be a density in a phase fluctuation. And what actually, what really is one-to-one, you can show the density fluctuations are the conjugate momentum on the emergent space. So you derive the full quantum picture. So what you see is here, from an outer observer, it's just a density and a phase fluctuation. From an inner observer, it's a field and it's conjugate momentum on the emergent space. And this really have to check. There are some models where the commutators are not in agreement with the wave equation. So let's come back to the linearization. This is all true on the linear level. So let's say a lot of effects when we do quantum field theory in curved spacetime, we neglect back reaction. So this is where the gravitational field will not be affected by the quantum field, basically. So the gravitational field is just a static entity. So and at these levels, these two models are really a perfect match. But if you go into, if you want to look at back reaction and dynamics, you really have to do a very careful analysis. So now we come to the core thing. So when I say emerge from the space-time sphere, the exponent has to be very careful. So when we look at, now we want to learn something about space-time. And if we want to do this, we say, for example, the first thing we look at will be signature. Because if you think about it in GR, the signature of space-time is not determined by the Einstein equations. There is a paper by Kaltenbrunner pointing out that basically both signatures would be allowed, but so randomly, you know, if we live in Lorentzian signature, but we don't really know why. In these space-times, there is actually, in this emergent space-time, there is an answer for it. And what we will see is that the space-time of our emergent, so the emergent space-time signature, is correlated with the microscopic interactions. How these atoms interact, if it's repulsive or attractive, this really determines the signature of the emergent space-time. So in some sense, you also have a mechanism to change the signatures you have from outside. So you can perform signature change units. And actually, such an experiment has been performed with other people knowing it. So I will talk about this experiment, and I will talk about what can we learn from that. Then I will talk about quantum gravity phenomenology. Because since we said if you use the symmetry trick that you break explicitly the SO2 symmetry of the fundamental Hamiltonian, you can generate a massive, so you have the massive Klein-Gordon equation. From there, then you can incorporate these Lorentz symmetry breaking terms and can ask things like naturalist problem, universality problem in the Lorentz symmetry breaking. And last but not least, so another thing was another idea. When Bill came up with this model, there was a big problem. And he thought, okay, obviously I have Hawking radiation. But you know, if you come closer to the horizon, you have this ultraviolet problem that all the modes get blue shifted. So by doing this the original derivation by Hawking, there would be this problem that actually the modes are so much blue shifted that you basically get in the regime where we don't trust quantum field theory in curved space time anymore. So Bill said, like, okay, so we know there is a natural cutoff in these models, which is the interatomic spacing. You cannot have wavelength and excitation, which is smaller than that, obviously. So there is a cutoff. So does this mean really that there is no Hawking radiation? So what they looked at, so he said, okay, in order to incorporate it, he first thought I have to incorporate all the microscopic degrees of freedom, which is a problem you cannot solve, basically. But then Ted Jacobson looked at it and said, no, it's not true. Because if you remember this Fogel-Yubov dispersion relation, this next order correction, the k to the fourth term, is this effective field theory, is this modification. So instead of looking at the whole system, you can just write down an effective field theory for our system, where incorporate basically this Lorentz symmetry breaking term, which is the modifications in the macroscopic variables, and then see if the Hawking radiation is really robust. What we have done the same for cosmological particle production, because they are really matters. So one of the big outcomes, achievements of, if you want, this field, was that actually Hawking radiation is robust against this model-specific modifications. So what does this mean? So I find it amazing that you have space-times from so many different models, you get space-times emerging. And some of the effects you want to mimic are completely independent of its substructure. Even these quantum effects, even effects where you would say that because you have this, you know, the notion of a horizon, the modes get blue shifted or something like that, you would think that here really the microscopic physics should matter, but indeed the effects are robust. So signature space time. So actually I said already a few things to this. Just so why do we live in this particular, why do we have the signature we have? And it seems to be like almost a little bit random because GR is not really constraining the signature. So what I want, I think I don't want to go too much into it, but so this is what I want to make. GR does not really give an answer why we live in the signature. And so you can always slice up space-time in non-interacting spatial slices, where basically it's a shift, and the labs tells you, a shift tells you how to stack these three spaces together, and the labs really tells you basically the distance between these two hypersurfaces. And so if you have in Lorentzian signature, this would be a minus n squared, so basically you would have negative distance. So what about BC? So we know in the BSC, we have this emergent spacetime. So we send it here. So basically, we now set the background velocity to zero. If we do this, we look at. So this is common, this is common, this. So we're left with Minkowski spacetime. Let's say we have no space dependence of the speed of sound. We're in a uniform trap. So what we see is basically this is c squared. And c squared is a function of the speed of sound is given by the density, the condensate density, times the interactions divided by the mass of the atoms. So there are now two cases. So if you have repulsive interaction, you get Lorentzian signature. If you have attractive interaction, you have Riemannian signature. So the idea to look at this came from this experiment. It was called
the Bosin. Can I ask something? Doesn't that mean that you have instability? Because, I mean, to switch the sign, that means c squared is negative.
But it's negative, but so first of all, so it triggers instabilities because basically now you have quantum field theory on Riemannian manifolds. You know, you produce a lot of particles and coincidences. But you also have to think the fundamental theory is that just the bounds of atoms, if they are positive or effective, this doesn't matter.
Yeah, but this effective description breaks down because you assume you have a small perturbation on top of the background.
Right.
But if these perturbations are unstable, then you have a small perturbation.
Yeah, so here's the trick. The idea is you do it for a short term, and usually it wouldn't matter. Even if you do it for a short time, you would expect infinite variable reduction for one. But because of the nature of the macroscopic modifications, we actually do not excite the high frequency modes. And the idea is actually only the low frequency modes experience emergent space time. The high ones don't see the space time, or they don't see the signature of the space time. And that's an amazing result. That's why this can happen here. So, but you're right, you have to do it for a very short time, you have to go back. Back reaction will matter, will play a role. But however, the microscopic modification is quantum pressure term, I'll talk about this, stabilizes the system measure. Because signature and space time is only right on large scales. So, they did this experiment and they did exactly this. They changed the interaction strengths, A, they went from a small positive value to negative. And they went back to a positive one in order to detect it. So what this really means, this is basically a Riemannian region for the condensate sandwiched in between two Lorentzian regions. So they've done this experiment, and what they've seen is jets and bursts of atoms coming out. So the question is of course, if someone does GR, yes.
If this is in time, so they change.
In time.
So U is an external potential.
Right. So you take external magnetic fields, it's called a Fechner resonance, and you can basically change the interactions of the atoms. And you can change it from an attractive to repulsive. You have your proposal sitting there, external magnetic fields, and you manipulate the interaction states, and even the sign. So they've done this experiment, and then, so what this means, this looks like something like that. So now we really have a space time that goes from Minkowski to unresolved. Because the way we are looking at it, you go from a constant value, to constant positive to constant negative to constant positive, basically you go from Minkowski flat to Euclidean flat to back to Minkowski flat.
And does c squared go to zero?
So this is a point. There, and this is something I think is still an outstanding problem. They've done it both ways. They've done it once where they actually, before going back to positive, they went to they stayed for at zero for a time. So they went through from negative to zero to positive, or from zero from negative to positive. And the outcome was a different. Because you're right, then you have a degeneracy. That's a degenerate space time. So you can do it both ways. You can really, but you also have to think about it just because. This is something just because the speed of sound goes to zero, the interaction strength, there's still some internal quantum pressure there. So basically, even though it looks like it goes to zero, then the higher order modification of dispersion relation are the ones that matter. So, but only for the k equals zero mode, basically, which is the common state that can really go to zero. So here was it. There was this paper by Le Coup and Garcetta, and they had this idea. They said, which actually brought us to look at this, they said, you know, this whole particle interaction process is something like squeezing and amplifying of quantum mode, an analog to cosmological particle production. But what actually happened is that if you go through signature change, it's not just cosmological particle production, it is more. You really change the signature. But they compared it already. They said, in order to understand what's going on in the Bosanova experiment, you have to look at the excitations, at the quantum excitations. So this just quickly, so you know, basically, when you look at cosmological particle reduction, you know that the super hyperbolizing modes, the effective frequency for super hyperbolizing modes changes. So then you have, instead, if they are sub hyperbolizing, you have some, first you start with plane waves, so you have some Bessel functions, but still you have oscillation. Super hyperbolizing modes are exponential. Exponentially growing and down. So they just get dragged along with the space time fabric. So if you have something where the effective frequency changes sign, you expect a lot of particle reduction. In the same sense, that's for super hyperbolizing modes in cosmology. So this is why you know you expect a lot of particle reduction if you now just change the effective frequency. So this is why signature change and super hyperbolizing mode are similar. But the differences in cosmology only not the whole the whole range of wavelengths is excited, basically changes the sound. So in some sense you can say once you go to Riemannian signature, all modes are frozen, nothing can propagate anymore. So we did this now, and one thing we knew already from previous simulation is that, but let me first say, you say what this Lorentz symmetry breaking, this basically this correction, this k to the fourth term, it comes into the game when you include the so-called quantum pressure term. And this quantum pressure term, we can explain this very nicely. The quantum pressure term is when you neglect that the kinematic energy is much less than the potential energy in your fundamental Hamiltonian. And what this really means is also that if you go to short wavelengths, there is a so-called healing wave, which is associated with this quantum pressure. And you said this notion of mean field does not make sense on very small scales. There's a minimum scale over which density fluctuations in the quantum zone tend to bulk out. So if you're above this longer, for longer wavelengths, they don't notice really the quantum pressure. They see this nice mean field of quantum state. For smaller ones, they basically see that, you know, it's getting a little bit rougher there. It's not a nice mean field. So this is the nature of the perturbation. So what we did is, so this is basically just a, so C is a function where, so basically, in order to include the quantum pressure term, it's, so this would be the interaction strength. You get an effective interaction strength, which is the external one plus this quantum pressure contribution. So now look, let's look at the particle reduction. We've calculated this. We also actually run, so what you see is, let me explain this. This shows, this T shows the length of the Euclidean region. So remember, we go from Lorentzian to Euclidean and back to Lorentzian. And this T is a time scale, how long we stay from an external viewpoint, where we have an absolute time, we can easily say this, how long do we stay in this Euclidean region? And what we see is obviously, as red it gets, basically, so here we plot, sorry, it's not there, this is basically K, this is the particles produced over K. So basically, one line corresponds a spectrum after you exposed your quantum fields to Riemannian signature for a certain time. So what you see here is actually that as long as you stay in this region, as more particles are produced. What is even worse, if you go to very high energies, what you see, there's no cutoff. So it would excite all the modes, really, exponentially growing. But if you include, this is without including this quantum pressure. If you include the quantum pressure term, what really happens is you see it is growing, but here this is the healing length. So basically it's growing up to the healing length, and then it's oscillating and going down. So we can explain this whole spectrum really. So this is all because of this modification. Because we have this, it's, you know, basically you still have a well-defined effective field theory even on the Riemannian signature, because the high energetic modes really don't see the change in signature. So we can also explain.
This change the effective theory makes the Lorentz invariant.
Yes, but only at high energies. So this yes. So these analog monons are not perfect monons. We also come back to this cosmon. So it's an immersion Lorentz symmetry. But immersion also in the sense that only for low, so the only low energetic perturbations, small k values, they have a uniform speed of sound, therefore monic ones. Higher ones actually act as if a k dependent speed of sound is, and that's when the knowledge breaks down. But I'll come back to this because these modifications are such that basically they are very similar as expected from many effective field theories. You know, the field theories from normal standard field theory, nothing to do with this emerging one. So the kind of modifications you're getting are not completely unreasonable in a sense as we expected them to be.
So you're saying something like, well, we know it can't really be infinite because it's a finite system.
For example.
And so this is just a way of. A nice way in the effective theory of
I'll come back to this because of the time. So just let me explain it. So what really happens is, so this would be just if you go through a two-step process because you go from one region, you have two sudden steps. And if you would do this without changing a signature, this is the spectrum you would get. This without quantum pressure, so you would have something oscillating between these two lines. This will be depending also how long the intermediate regime is. And if you include quantum pressure, this is how the spectrum is bent, basically. And if you then compare it, what you really see is that the low energetic spectrum behaves exactly as in the Heidenhausen limit for signature change, while the high energy spectrum really doesn't notice that a signature is changing, it just these sudden steps. So you really can explain the spectrum very well. Okay, so now I really need to speed up. What is amazing? We looked at the fact, so if you would put in some corrections by hand, you put in some Dalam version purely spatial with spatial derivatives, you would add some corrections to your field theory of some effective field theory. And if you calculate the particle reduction, if you would do it in the naive manner, you basically wouldn't change it. You still have the particle reduction still be in symmetry. So basically, you still will have exponential growth. And so it makes it even worse because now it's growing even faster with k, because it has this additional k dependence and makes the spectrum faster. But in these analog monos, it really happens in a different way. In analog monos, basically, since this modification here, this one, does not get shifted. So basically, if you change the sign of m squared and this one, this still has the same sign. You cannot change the sign in front of this. So if you can always find a high enough k so that all of the effective frequency is positive, and then there's no signature change. So this is, you know, to explain there's no particle. So basically, here the situation is a much different one. So how can we explain this? So it seems to me that signature change events are very strange things. We don't understand very well. However, if there is some mechanism, you could say, okay, but what if I include back reaction in this effect? But if you don't have any Lorentz breaking scale, if you don't have anything in there, whenever you go to a Riemannian signature, you produce an infinite amount of particles per volume. At that stage, back reaction should also be completely, I mean, it's so violent. It doesn't seem that you can renormalize these things easily. So, but at least in these emergent space times, because of the kind of the microstructure, Lorentz signature change events are actually much better behaved, are well behaved. So, you all know what quantum gravity phenomenology is. Let's say we have some quantum theory of gravity. How would it affect our known theories? How kind of modifications would we get? And so there are two kind of quantum, you know, Lorentz. One big issue in quantum gravity phenomenology is to look at deviations, modifications, and dispersion relations, so Lorentz symmetry breaking at high energies. There are two major concepts. One is this presence of a preferred frame, and the second one is this W special relativity. So we are focusing on the first one. And what we found is actually, if you look at these analog models, you could say, well, these are so different systems, really, as electromagnetic wave pipes, they're fluids. So this kind of correction could be really arbitrary. But what's actually very surprising, if you compare, for example, you get some very similar modifications. So you get that depending on the initial symmetries, you get either a K to the 3 term, but in most of the cases where you start with a system that's parity, so basically you see that you only get either super or subsonic corrections. So this really means that they are not that different. While the microscopic theory is very, very different, the effective field theories are very similar. So I think this is also actually a nice result from this analog model that if you have a microscopic structure, you know, the first correction in the effective field series is almost, you know, it's not really dependent or so, but we're talking about a plus or a minus. We're talking about, so it's not that strongly dependent, it's just a class of modifications you get. So this kind of gives trust in all this concept of effective field series, because, you know, the microscopic structure at that level simplifies. So now what we want to do, can we extend the class of fields? And the idea was, how can we get the mass effect citation? So how can we get the mass effect citation? And the idea is, we go back to the fundamental Hamiltonian and write explicitly the SO2 symmetry. And because we know, we have this Bolstone theorem that because this is spontaneously breaking symmetry when the condensate forms, so therefore, we cannot expect a mass effect citation. So we write symmetry explicitly, and how we do it is, so what we do, we have a condensate with two different atoms in a sense. We have atoms in two different hyperfine states. We can couple them with labor couple. We couple these two. So it will be M minus 1 and M plus 1. We would couple between drive transitions between these two different kinds of atoms. So we write down the Hamiltonian for this more complicated theory and you get this term. So now, this is a very simple point. So this is a closed system. The string is closed. We don't couple to any other state. It's a number conserving approach. So we don't run, so you still expect some condensation. So if you look at the symmetry, so before you had for condensate A and condensate B, both had without the coupling, without the lambda coupling, had this SO2 symmetry. If you now couple these systems together, you replace this two symmetry with a single symmetry, and this is under simultaneous changes of these two phases. So now I have these two condensate. When I perturb, I get two excitations. I still have one symmetry, so I will always get a massless gap. But the second one is then free to have a mass, because the Bolstone model says only one of them has to be massless. Because I have one symmetry, which basically gives me, which will be explicitly broken when I form the condensate, it still gives me a massless one, but the second excitation then will be a massless one. So the situation is not that easy, because if you play these games, at the end, what you see is that you also get a richer geometrical structure. So as soon as you have this condensate, it's not a mass, it's a Finsler spacetime. And you have to tune the condensate parameter actually to go to monometric structures. So you have these two condensates, which basically have the same sound speed at the low energetic level. So how to see this? So what this means, so actually the idea why you have a massive excitation can be explained very nicely. If you have one condensate, look at this one red dot, there's one excitation. If you have two dots, they can be in phase or antiphase. And exactly that's what you get. You get like this two excitation. The in phase one has a zero mass. The anti phase one basically has a non-zero mass, which goes to zero if the coupling goes to zero. Because remember, the coupling was the one breaking the explicit symmetry. So now is we want to know how this happens. You know, how does this system react if we look at Lorentz violation? So basically, we went to this regime and you know, incorporated quantum the quantum pressure term. It's a very long derivation, but actually, what comes out is very beautiful. We get this modification. This is our dispersion relation. So at first, if you look at it, you would say there's an eta 2 term. This is bad. However, this eta 2 term is naturally suppressed because it's a ratio between the mass of the quasi particle to the effective Planck scale. Effective Planck mass specification. So basically, this natural is small. And here, this eta 4, basically, once you pulled out this Planck suppression here, is of order 1. So it means that this correction is very, very small. It's naturally suppressed. While the second one, you don't get a further suppression mechanism for the fate of the photon. So there was an issue if you have this Lorentz symmetry breaking. Why should it only affect the case of the photon, and why does it not propagate through to the case of the two term? So in these models, it does propagate through, but it's naturally suppressed. Okay, so now we might have to cut down on, unfortunately, on, I think, on cosmology, but can I have 5 minutes?
Yes, 5 minutes.
Okay, so let me go. I wanted to show we did some simulations for Bose-Einstein condensate where we actually incorporated all the back reaction, all the things, and we tested the theory. And the back reaction is not the problem. What is the problem is this correction again. So actually, when you want to mimic inflation, you have to set your parameters regime very well because you have a tiny pending Planck scale in the system. So you can have cosmology in a condensate because you look at sound waves. If you have a time dependence in the sound waves, means for equal distances traveled, if the sound waves get, the sound speed gets smaller and smaller, you travel longer and longer. So effectively, it looks like an expanding universe. But there are a lot of problems which are not due to the fact that, you know, you don't incorporate this dynamics, the full dynamics. It's actually this effective, this modification where the analogy breaks down. So it is very difficult, actually. So in short, the particle production is not robust against this Lorentz symmetry breaking effect, only for a short time. So let me see. I think so. What you actually see is that naturally, for the modes, once because you have a time dependent Planck scale, once the mode goes from phononic, which was phononic at some time, at a later time becomes transphononic. Once it's transphononic, it decouples from the spacetime. It basically, the expansion stops and it decouples from the spacetime. And what you see is actually that at the same time, this shows us the particle production here, the particle production comes to an end. So what this also means, usually during inflation, it would recover for freezing and freezing of modes, but then there's a turnaround once the mode decouples from the spacetime and it starts melting again. So obviously, it's a completely different situation.
What is transphononic?
Transphononic means when the scale, let me put it this way. If you have your dispersion diagram, so there's a linear part, which are the phononic modes, and then basically there's a point when you know the quadratic term is dominant. So phononic modes are the ones where linear behavior, and transphononic modes are the ones basically where the Lorentz breaking scale has to be. So, and then this is fun stuff, and then I'll stop. What about singularities? So, can we have singularities in emergent space-time? So, let's look back at the tornado. The tornado, because of how the physics work, you can never form a singularity. Whatever the mechanism is, it seems that, you know, naturally, the formation of a singularity is protected. What about the vorticity? Well, there is a problem here because in order to study a noisy fluid with a vorticity, with a vortex, if you want to incorporate this, basically, you need to look at the small scales. But at the small scales, the effective description for our sound waves breaks down. So we cannot really tell this one. What about the BEC? Well, I told you that very sure, so going to singularities, you need a very small resolution. You need to go to the very high energetic wavelengths that you see the singularities. But we know already that for these modes, they don't couple to the emergent spacetime picture. We've seen this in the cosmological particle reduction. We have seen this in the signature space and signature change events. So we know there is no singularity because the notion of spacetime breaks down when it would come to this. So I now found something really nice, and it's a still film. So I found this movie. And what it's basically is about is they say they let milk dropping on a rotating slice, and it sees how basically if you have a notion of fluid of space time, it takes a bit, so it's running. So let's go slow this way. Very slowly. So what you see is, when you look at the drop of milk falling down on this, so here you see this milk coming down the needle, the drop of milk, and there's this spinning disc they're having. And what they do, basically, they change the parameter. They change the rotation velocity. So here we have this initial milk drop. So when you swim a small height and a small rotation, you see basically that this fluid, which you can always look at like a little piece of space-time, is bouncing back. So if you then change the parameter and you do something very violent, it basically is, you see already here it splits up in little baby universe. And if you want to see, so they call it black hole because they get this sign which has nothing to do with black hole. But what I'm saying, what you maybe can see from this is that if you have space-time, if you have like some mean field, if of course you put a big force on it, so the shiny thing because it's so nice. If you put a big force of it, then suddenly, you know, this whole mean field description breaks down. Suddenly the microscopic structure is the one that is important. And I think this is what these emergent space-times are about. It's really telling us exactly this. If space-time is emergent, small scales, there's a different physics that's dominating. And then, for example, I think you will have problems to find a singularity or have a signature change on the small scales. And last but not least, where is that going us? These are new toy models. And the idea is something I'm really intrigued about is let's extend this picture because it seems there is no end. There are people who have found a spin 2 particle emerging from a system different than the Einstein equation. So what they actually, there are two models. One is the one that has four-dimensional quantum Hall effect, and they looked at perturbation on the boundary. And what they saw a spin 2 particle emerging, and it's also there's a quantum rotor model. And this quantum rotor model, they also got the spin 2 particle. So the question is now, can we, if we have systems like that, what can we really say about the dynamics? Is there some subsystem of this dynamic which actually is equal to the linearized Einstein equations? So what I'm saying, if you want to get gravity out of it, I think the way to go is to say I need at least 2 degrees of freedom, because gravity has 2 degrees of freedom. It has a spin 2 particle. And any quantum matter system where we expect some gravity should basically have this same degrees of freedom, should have an expectation like that. So, and that's almost it. My last movie. I'd like to thank you for your invitation and also all the people at the PI. And I found it really fascinating. So what you see here is a sample, a Tibetan instrument, and it's filled with water. And so he does now, he excites basically. It creates sound waves propagating the fluid, the bouncing off and gets reflected on the boundary. And I find it amazing. So imagine like this surface is out, you know, it's a 2+1 dimensional space time, you have these quantum fluctuations in it, and you excite like all these little ripples. Like.
Is that a bottle of wine?
No, it's a. It's water, it's the sound hole, it's water in it, and he just excites the sound waves.
So what's in the bottle?
It's just water. It's just water, yes, yeah. So because the sound waves, as you propagate in the fluid, they're, you know, fracking and bouncing over the boundaries, interfere, and you really see how these little excitations, which basically are living in this, if you want to look at the surface effective space-time geometry, how they basically excited. So actually, this was the message I want to bring abroad. Actually, I wanted to say that space-time seems to be everywhere. It's not some abstract concept. It's not something only gravity. And I hope if I convinced you with that, and if you look at the glass of water, you think, "Me, it's an emerging space-time," then I'm happy.
Thank you for the very nice talk. Are there any questions or comments? Joints?
Yeah, so I have a question about this business of preserving Lorentz invariant. So I suppose the real test would come when you had an emergent picture with interacting fields, because you know there was this argument about vector field theory, whether you had an interacting field of magnetic directions would lead to limit breaking at lower scales than the natural scale that you were talking
right,
about.
So yeah.
Is there some way, I mean, have any experiments been done or any models being built which have?
No. I think started looking, you know, like what if you have really exactly the same type of fields, how would this come down, but no, no one has to really work on this.
Do you have any other comment about that? Do you think about it as a big worry?
So basically the problem was, you know, if you study basically, if you're at a linear level where you neglect back reaction, so basically linear level means you don't have this interaction curve. So it really have really go back. In some sense, you also, in order that looking at the system and also say we really learn something for quantum field theory in space-time, you need some, you know, dynamics which basically you need a better system than that, because you get first you get some modifications, but what does, you know, what are they telling us? So actually, it's a very good comment you make, but I don't think anybody has really studied this.
You talked about the cosmology, you sort of skimped on time, so I'm not sure I heard what you said. Did you say that in fact the kind of particle production is not robust against the details of the model?
Yes.
In that case, because that's what I would have guessed that, so I don't, that's what you said.
So
and I'll tell you why I would have guessed it.
Okay, so why would you have guessed it?
Well, because the reason why this goes back to the discussion Bill and I had a long time ago. I don't know if he remembers that, but I think the reason why the Hawking radiation is robust has to do with stability. Whenever you have a situation where the background has a symmetry, a translation symmetry, which it does say in the black hole, but there's a time translation symmetry, then some equilibrium of the state of the quantum field will be established. And you can argue on quite general grounds that an equilibrium state has to be a thermal state for a complicated system. So you get essentially all the main facts about the Hawking radiation. I think the tie of the mass to the temperature is not there. So in the case of the black hole, but all the other main facts are there. But it depends very heavily on having the possibility of setting up an equilibrium state. Whereas in the expanding universe, unless it had some conformal, and if you're dealing with photons and you had some conformal invariance or something, which was under which it was stationary, you could make the same argument, but in general you couldn't.
So I think that there's a different, maybe the way robustness, I mean, first of all, independent of how to say. So there is a big regime, you set up the regime probably, it is robust against it. It's just because at some stage, you lose all your phononic regime.
You're talking about the cosmology.
Yes. So it's not that, you know, you don't see the effect. You see the effect, but it's only, you know, basically, if you want to compare it what we think how cosmological particle production should look like, it's only valid in a certain regime. As long as the mode is freezing, you can always find a regime where the quantum modes are freezing, where they do exactly the same. But then we know already from the analogy holds in this part. In this part, it doesn't. So what happens in this cosmology model, it gets shifted. And eventually, while the speed of sound is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, this thing gets shifted to zero. And then you don't have an analog model anymore. All nodes have decoupled from the space. So
are you saying?
Yes. So it is, in some sense, you have the effect. Regardlessly, the effect is there. It's just that the analogy is not that simple. It is not that once, because of the microstructure, you won't see this particle production. It's still there. It is on. You can always find regimes where it looks exactly the same way. But if you do it too long, then basically you don't have an analog model anymore. You don't have this phononic regime. So it is robust in some sense. The effect is there. You know, it doesn't really, it's not dominated by the microstructure. But at some stage, you're losing your regime where it applies to.
But at some point, you're in the right regime, you see exactly the right.
Yes, there's exactly.
And is it for massless particles?
Yes, it's for
mass. That's the one case where you have the conformal in there. So I guess I would have guessed that for massive particles, it wouldn't.
So So basically, you could, because as I said, we have a two-component BSC, you could say I could set up a massive analysis.
You look at that?
The problem is when you, if you want to do this, as I briefly pointed out, the geometry is much more complex, and then you need some tuning in order to. But in principle, you could actually go back and do it, but it's a very tight analysis. But yeah, maybe you know their situation is really different. I don't know.
Comments? No? Okay, so let's thank you, Jacob.